I'm Lonnie, alcoholic. Thank you, Matt, for inviting me. Thank you all for having me. Thank you all for being here. This is the first time I've ever spoken at a meeting, so I wasn't really sure what to do or how to do it. Matt gave me, sorry to keep throwing your name out, but he just gave me the advice of, give us your experience, strength, and hope. And I thought about that over the last week or so, and I know it's customary to talk about where I was and where I am now, but I don't really want to focus on where I was. I like to remind myself that there's a reason that the rearview mirror is a lot smaller than the windshield. I try to keep looking forward. There's another little piece of wisdom that's on a rearview mirror as well, and it's one of the reasons I don't like to stare into the past too hard, and that is that objects in the rearview mirror often appear larger than they actually are. I guess I should say I find wisdom and comfort in metaphors. So if I say something crazy, I hope the meaning behind it gets through. But it helps me to kind of understand where I'm going. There were a few things that came up for me this week that really got me thinking about where I am and what I'm doing and how I'm doing that. And one of the things that came up was the idea of the pink cloud. And it struck me that the pink cloud is that portion of the relationship when you've just met and everything's super exciting and everything's, you know, just way over the top crazy and it's all you can think about. And that's fine and that's good. But we often hear, you know, people say, well, you know, just wait until that's over, wait until the pink cloud has gone away, or, you know. And what I realized is that's that part of the relationship when that puppy love and that infatuation goes away and what's left is something richer and stronger. And it's that true love, right? And that's what I hope for, you know, once that pink cloud is lifted, that's what I hope for, is that strong, powerful relationship that I now have, with AA. And while I was thinking of that, it struck me that, you know, I had a relationship with alcohol too. And that was important to me because I realized that I have really fond memories of some of the times back when, you know, when I was out and about and drinking and gallivanting around and I realized that was okay to have those fond memories. It was okay. It was okay to remember the good times. But it was also important to see that relationship that I had was ultimately very, very destructive and would have wound up killing me. And it was okay to put that relationship aside and allow it to be in the past, but not to dwell on all of the terrible things that happen, right? For me, it's a form of self-forgiveness to be able to do that. To, you know, to say, yeah, it was fun at one point, and then it wasn't, and then it was abusive, and it was terrible, and it was time to get out. And it wasn't the same at the end as it was in the beginning. But to be able to recognize and identify that it's okay to, there's no guilt in having a fond memory of that time when you were out at the bar with a friend. There's no guilt or shame in that. It's okay. It reminded me of humility, right? We talked about humility. And I came across this week one of the most powerful examples of humility to me that I've seen. And it, the reason that it's so powerful is because it's not, it wasn't self-deprecating, and it wasn't over the top or anything like that. And it was, and I don't know, some of you may have seen this, it was Mr. Rogers. And there's a episode that Mr. Rogers filmed where he asks, you know, his audience, generally children, he asks them, do you like to draw with crayons? And he picks up a crayon and he starts to draw on a board, and he says, I'm not very good at it. But that doesn't matter. And that simple statement of humility is so powerful to me, because he's saying that he's not good at it, and he's drawing anyway. And he goes on to say that that's the important thing, is that we do it anyway. You know, because sometimes I don't feel like I'm very good at life, but I'm doing it anyway. I had my time. Another vision that I had was, you know, and again, I see wisdom all over the place. And I feel like for me, I have to look everywhere. It's always there. It's always looking at you. It's just a matter of whether or not I want to take the time to understand the lesson. And it's in silly little things. It's in realizing that I was Pinocchio on the island of toys, and that I, you know, and I drank and gambled, and I started to begin to turn into an ass. Now this is my opportunity to get away from that. What I've discovered for me is that growth and the answers are all around you. And it just takes a moment. And I think this is what AA has given me. It's just given me that opportunity to take a step back, take a breath, and just experience the world, and let the world experience me. And find selflessness in being able to selfishly see that I am in everything around me. And therefore taking care of those things is taking care of me. There's always the old stories of the individual that wants to find the meaning of life. And so they set out on this great, great journey, to go to the mountaintop and find the wise man in the cave, sitting by himself. And I was thinking about that today, and what I realized was that if you did the journey right, if you traveled right, and you looked around, then by the time you got to the top of that mountain and you found that old wise man in that cave, you wouldn't have the question of what is the meaning of life. It would just be your turn in the cave. And so that's my advice. That's where I get my strength and my experience is that realization, that eye-opening realization that all of the things that I'm looking for are already all around me, right? Everything that's worth saying has already been said. It's just a matter of being open, right? And this is the first, you know, few steps of AA is all about becoming willing, becoming open to receiving that wisdom, and that's where I'm at, and hopefully that's where I'm going. So that's about 30 seconds short, Tammy, but but I will kick it over. Thank you all again for coming, and thank you for having me.
I'm Jennifer. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And thank you, Matt, for inviting me to speak. And thank you all for being here. Welcome, newcomers, and one or two people I see who I know. Thanks for coming. It's been a bit of a stressful day for me. We have a fire about less than 2 miles away as the crow flies from this house. And it's been a day of packing everything. So it's packing in case the whole house burns down, packing in case I'm just away for a day, packing just for the night, packing maybe not everything. You know, I had to stay very centered and very focused, and it's taken all of my 35 years of sobriety to do this with any grace, let me tell you, not having any meltdowns. Lay down for half an hour, that was about it. And it all went well, and the air is clear, and I'm here. And I'm very, very grateful for the firefighters and for these amazing airplanes with tankers that swoop over Tamales Bay and scoop up the water and then fly directly over my house real low, skimming the trees and dropping the water on the fire. It's been a very exciting day. So I got sober in 1985. I am now sober longer than I drank, and I drank for a good 25 years. A good rock solid hard drinking 25 years. I did smoke grass from when I woke up in the morning until, oh, I don't know, for about 20 years, until I realized one day that I didn't like the way I felt, which was amazing to me. But I started drinking at 15, and that was always the base. You know, whatever else I did, there's always a drink involved, and I love drinking in bars. Not at 15, because they wouldn't let me in. But by the time I was 17, they did. I was like that little mascot girl, you know, that they'd give beer and the coffee cup to in various places and look out for me. And I sort of found a family there. I came from a family where no one drank. I don't have a very classic alcoholic story that way. I come from a family where they had religious objections to drinking. They didn't even drink coffee. So I didn't go to doctors, and nobody drank. And I didn't even know about taking aspirin until I was drinking for years. And somebody said, oh, you can take an aspirin. You know, I only did recreational drugs. I didn't do, any other kind of drugs that could actually make you, you know, get better until much later. Anyway, so I left home at 16 and a half. I got my high school equivalency diploma between my junior and senior year. And from where I came from, this was unheard of. Nice girls from the neighborhoods I came from didn't do this. And my parents didn't know what to do with me. So they sent me to their friends in Holland, who thought that I was too thin and really ought to be drinking beer and stout, which they had stacked to the rafters in their garage. And I thought that was pretty fabulous myself. And it was very relaxing. And I also smoked madly. And I was skinny as a rail. And I drank my beer and drank my stout and smoked my cigarettes. And tried to seduce their son. And was generally kind of a naughty 16, 17-year-old girl in Europe. I wound up meeting a guy and hitchhiking to Berlin in 1963. Right after the wall went up, we were smuggling peace literature into East Berlin. Don't ask, on the subway every day, you know. And I would come back, I would drink with those kids in East Berlin, get drunk as a skunk, and you had to be back into West Berlin by midnight on the subway. And I would be shouting and screaming and talking and singing, and I thought it was hilarious fun, and, you know, squatting down in the road to take a pee because I drank so much giant steins of beer they had there with these guys, and, you know, singing We Shall Overcome, who knows what, you know, peace songs. I don't know who I thought I was. But anyway, it was, you know, wild and exciting and pretty much fun and involved a lot of drinking already. And I came back at the beginning of 1964 was it 62 or 60? No, it was 62 that I went there. I came back at the beginning of 63, pregnant and very young and just having turned 17. And I couldn't get, there were no legal abortions, and the illegal guys wouldn't do it unless they told my parents. Anyway, long story, I wound up getting pregnant twice that year. I didn't learn, and I did have two abortions. And I only say this because drinking and pot, which I had newly discovered at that around that time, and, you know, cough medicine and whatever else was going, helped me just kind of not feel any consequences of that. And when I got sober, when I was 39, I had to mourn that time, you know, kind of all over, sort of all those feelings rose up. So what I was doing without knowing I was doing it was I had found a way to sort of be in the world and not feel too much, not admit to myself that I was actually rather scared being a well-brought up suburban girl out in the big world, getting pregnant, trying to go to school, dropping out of school. I really did take Timothy Leary's message to heart. You know, I thought tune in, turn on, drop out was for me, or maybe it was the other way around, turn on and then tune in. In any event, I thought, yes. And I dropped out is what I did. I was a chronic dropout. And part of that was one of the things I couldn't face and didn't know how to do was to take exams. I didn't know how to stand up and be accountable. So I have incompletes from numerous schools around the East Coast and the Midwest. I sort of worked my way from Philadelphia to Chicago to California, staying a semester here and a semester there, because when it came time for exams, I would leave. I just couldn't do it. And I didn't know, had not a clue how to ask anybody for help. I assumed that you had to do it on your own. You know, that's how I was raised. You did this world on your own. And I can do that. Thank you very much. Because the way I do it is I stay nicely stoned. And I had many ideas about that, you know, is of the propriety of not getting too drunk, not getting too stoned, using this drug and not that drug because that one was uncool. No speed other than occasionally when you really needed it. You know, I thought I had the chemistry kind of balanced. I did a lot of psychedelics in those early days, 17, 18, 19 years old. And learned that I didn't like doing them with a bunch of other people. And took what I needed and left the rest. And don't really feel bad about that. I liked what Lonnie had to say about, you know, there were some good times. But somebody asked me when I was 19, by then I was living in New York City, if I thought I was an alcoholic. And I said, no, you know, certainly not. You know, I don't drink in the morning. Well, I drank all night. And in New York, the bars close at 4, and then you can drink after hours or just stay in that bar with the bartenders and drink. So, in fact, I was drinking in the morning. It's just that I wasn't going home, getting up early and having a drink, you know. So I found a way to do my life, especially this was what we're talking about, is that by now, I moved to New York in 1965. I was 19. I turned 20 that year. And you could live on next to nothing, which meant that you could get high all the time and you could drink. And I was still too young to drink in bars, but they would serve me. Well, in New York, it was 18, so I could drink. California, they served me anyway. And, you know, you're young and cute and long-haired and short-skirted, and you can usually get a drink in a bar. So I managed to have a job, but I didn't know what I was doing. I had no idea what I was doing. There's a quote that's been coming to me lately by Mary Oliver that says, "Tell me, what is it that you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" And I sure wish somebody had said that to me in 1965 when it was a very young, wild, and precious life. But nobody did. I just thought I needed to figure it out. I needed to do it alone or, you know, with a lot of other people I was getting high with, but not with any help. I wouldn't have known who to ask for help. My mother, who didn't go to doctors, would also not go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist. She said she'd go to an astrologer first. So I know a little bit about astrology, but I didn't get to a psychologist until I was 39, which led me into the rooms, thank goodness. So anyway, no, I said I didn't think I was an alcoholic. A bit later, I remember sitting in a bar that I loved in the village called the Ninth Circle, as in the Ninth Circle of Hell. That's what it was named after. And of course, we thought this was incredibly cool. And reading, somebody, it was daytime, and the light was sort of shafting through the front windows onto the peanut shells on the floor and the smell of the, you know, a bar in the morning. And somebody had the 12 questions or 11, whatever it is, from AA on the bar of, you know, do you miss work or do you... whatever the 11 questions are, we all answered them and all thought it was just hilarious. Oh, yeah, I guess we're alcoholics. Ha, ha, ha. We knew we were heavy drinkers. Some people were a lot heavier users of other things. That was one of my tricks to sort of feel that I was getting through this okay, was that I drank with much heavier hitters than I was, or heavier users. So I could feel like I was kind of okay because I wasn't as bad as you were. I wasn't as bad as Snooki or Big Tommy or some of the other characters I hung out with. I love to drink with the boys, and I love to drink when the bar is closed with the bartenders or the mafia guys in the after hours clubs that were actually a candy store that where they kept the booze and the well with the candy bars and the ice cream for the kids who would start coming in on their way to school in the morning. Anyway, that life sort of went on. I thought maybe that I ought to get married. So I did to a bartender, and that lasted about a minute and a half, actually about a year and a half. But, you know, in bar time, that's about a minute and a half. And I promptly fell in love with somebody else and ran off with him to Morocco, where one could stay in 1969 and stay really stoned. I think we had, I don't know, $800, and we stayed there for 6 months. It was like, you know, I don't know how we did it. But you could just stay really, really high, and that was my ideal. I used to say, a nice foot off the floor. And sort of a foot away from the wall, being a sort of an observer. I didn't want to be the main attraction. I wanted to be audience, basically. You know, I wanted to be background music. I wanted to sit there and look at you and feel like I was okay, maybe trying to do what you were doing, because God knows I didn't know what I was doing. I had thought I wanted to be an artist, and I got to New York at that time, and a kind of art was in vogue that I did not understand, and I didn't know how to say that I didn't understand it. I didn't know how to unsay that I didn't know what I was doing, and would somebody please help me? When I got sober, I realized, and I heard the expression, being comfortable in one's own skin, I realized that I never had been. I hadn't been as a kid. I hadn't been as a young drinking and drugging person in the 60s. And all I did was sort of get better and better at covering up the fact that I wasn't comfortable, covering up to myself and to you so that I could look cool and I could dress well and I could sound like I knew what I was doing. And I always had interesting friends and interesting jobs and sort of interesting jobs, you know. Wound up waitressing for a long time, but I waitressed in very interesting places with interesting people. So, I don't know. Anyways, life sort of went on, you know, and got by the time I was 25, let's see, I came back from Morocco pregnant, and this time I had a child who is my daughter, who will be 50 this year, amazingly enough. And her dad was also a bartender, my favorite thing. Bartender, dope dealer, bartender slash dope dealer. That's my really favorite thing. And we also started doing a lot of coke, actually, with the first bartender. In 1967, I started doing coke. He would bring me every Friday a bouquet of flowers and a gram of coke, which I thought was really a devoted husband. And of course, what I discovered was that it allowed me to drink more, which was the main reason for doing it. And the main reason I bring it up in AA meetings is because that drug and booze, basically, were my drugs of choice. Also, as I said, smoking dope, kind of all through all of it, as just sort of, you know, you ante up in the morning or settle down in the evening or whatever, or just sort of do it because somebody hands it to you, which was my thing. I just never said no. So in 1970, I had a child and I was 25, and we had a loft in Soho, early Soho, and a bar of our own for a little while until it went rapidly down the tubes. Anyway, things got wilder and wilder. The combination of being out, having a kid and having to be up during the day with her at least part of the time and stay up all night, which I was doing, was difficult and taking a wild toll on my health. I was starting to, you know, sort of see my hands look like they were really, really, really far away, and having perceptual problems, and worrying about when I was driving that I couldn't quite, anyway. So I wound up seeing a doctor who was doing a lot of work with megavitamin therapy and decided that I was schizophrenic and therefore I could have megavitamin therapy. I wasn't schizophrenic. I was doing a lot of coke is what I was doing. But B vitamins helped, let me tell you, and lots of vitamin doses, and I still take them to this day. I think that that is the reason I am still a healthy human being at 75 this October. Should I live that long? With the amount that I drank and the amount of coke that I did for all those years, I think the reason I managed to get through it is because I was taking vitamins all that time, to tell you the honest to God truth. And I was doing all those things like was read in the beginning of this meeting, you know. For a while I'd try it, just drink beer or just drink champagne or just drink, you know, not drink in this bar or not drink in that place, or I did all of those things. I did not take a health cure or go to a sanitarium or a rehab. I never went to rehab. I just did what I was doing. I don't think in those 25 years that I stopped drinking for more than a week. I couldn't. I would sometimes say I'll stop for Lent. I'm not a Catholic. It's nothing to do with Lent. But it seemed like a good idea. Again, let me try this for a whole month. I could never, ever do it. I could do a few days, maybe. And then I'd still be using drugs, you know, of course. We didn't stop everything, but I would try. So anyway, life went on. By the time I was 30, I had split up with my daughter's father. I was by myself in New York with a little girl who was starting school. And I started to get, to really get edgy and depressed. I was waitressing. I was working about three other jobs. I worked for a couple of different accessories designers. I was not making my own art. I was helping other people make their art. I was assistant to this one and assistant to that one. And working at night or daytime, I don't know. Anyway, there was always a way to get childcare with other people who worked in the bar business. We'd band together, or someone's older kid would babysit my daughter, and I'd come home at 6 in the morning. He said, well, he says, what about real estate? And I said, yes, that's it. I'll do that. I'll get a real estate license and move from being a waitress and living downtown to working in Midtown Manhattan at an all-women's real estate office in 1983. I guess I started there. It was the days of Dynasty, and everybody had suits with big shoulders and thought Alexis, whatever her name is, was like fabulous, and making $1 million before you were 30 was the way to go. I had never been into any of this. I'm a complete hippie, flower child, artist person. But I thought this was my geographic, you know, from 10th Street to 48th Street, and from being a downtown girl to being an uptown girl, haha. I lasted 3 years and it got me sober. That's the good news. I had to be there at 8 o'clock in the morning. It was an all-women agency. It was a piranha tank. It was so scary. I can't tell you. I met Donald Trump. I met Harry Helmsley. I met all of these like crazy New York real estate kind of guys that were quite frightening, and their lawyers who were even more frightening. And did some deals and made a little money, but not much. But to do it, I knew that I could not show up with the hangovers that I had. Because although I drank all night long, and I always had hangovers, I just figured you do. You know, you play, you pay. So what? And I would drink all night. I thought, oh, I'll just drink on weekends. I get this straight job uptown. I'll just drink on weekends. Well, I couldn't do it. You know, within 3 days, I was up all night. I would go home at 6 in the morning, send the babysitter home. By now, I didn't really, my daughter was approaching teenagerhood and didn't really need a babysitter. I would take a hot shower to sort of get the fumes out of me. I'd lie down for half an hour to get my heart rate down from all the coke I'd been doing to be able to stay up all night. I would smoke a pack of Cools between midnight and 6 in the morning and do as much coke as there was and drink a lot of whatever. I liked Grand Marnier. I liked tequila. I liked cognac. I liked whatever. When I started to really try and stop drinking, I drank scotch again, but otherwise I never drank anything so mundane. I liked heavy stuff, you know, that had a lot of sugar in it. Anyway, and then I'd go to work, you know. And I'd sit there at the desk and I'd make all these cold calls to all these people. And I would look at my hands and say, why are they not shaking? My whole body shook inside, but I wasn't shaking on the outside. And I thought, you know what? You're in your late 30s. This is not going to last. You know, one of these days, these shakes are going to move from the inside to the outside. My daughter by now is skipping school a lot and beginning to get in trouble. There were always these little yellow cards from her school. And she would say, oh, Mom, the computer's always down. And I would believe it because I hated going to her school and having to talk to anybody in charge because, of course, I thought it was all about me, you know. And I would get uptight about, ooh, and plus I always had a hangover and they wanted you to be there at, you know, 9 in the morning to talk to them. I couldn't do it. So I rarely did. Anyway, but I knew she was getting to be in trouble. Anyway, by the time I was in that real estate office for, I think, about 2 months, I was at my first AA meeting, and there was one right down the block. I had a good friend who lived, who had moved to LA from New York, and she's someone I drank a lot with and who was really smart and who drank more than I did. And I thought, and she had gotten sober. And I thought, oh my God, if Judy can get sober and she can like AA, I'd never really even thought about going to AA. The only thing I knew about it was Days of Wine and Roses, you know, with the shadows on the wall and the raincoats and the dismal sort of, oh God, the fun is all over now. But Judy said, oh, now it's fabulous. And of course, she was in LA, so she loved it. There were movie stars at all the meetings and all this stuff. Anyway, she said, no, I think you'd like it. So, and I think you need it. My downstairs neighbor had HIV, and he had stopped doing everything and gotten himself sober. And he would come up to my apartment and leave the literature on my coffee table, you know, very, very quiet, didn't say anything about it. He'd just leave brochures, leave those little folders that we have. So I was getting, it was coming in, you know, and it was coming in from people I liked, which had never happened before. So I went to my first meeting. It was right down the block from the office. It was kind of a mink coat meeting. They didn't have the stuff on the, they didn't have the things on the wall. It was kind of behind this spiritual bookstore. And these ladies would come in from Vogue magazine and, you know, wherever in their outfits. And I thought, oh, this is kind of fabulous. And I liked it a lot from day one, but I didn't, they didn't have the steps and on the wall. And you could run in and run out. It was a lunchtime meeting, and I ran in and run out so that nobody from work would know. So needless to say, Thanksgiving came, and you know, you got to have drinks with Thanksgiving dinner. You have to have wine and beer, and my brother had come down from Canada with lots of Canadian beer, and you know. So, and within a month, I was back at another meeting. And that went on for the next 14 months. In the midst of that time, one of my girlfriends, who was a wonderful writer in New York and a bit of a crazy lady, said, you know, she said, I think you're depressed. And I think you're angry and depressed. And I think you should see a therapist, my therapist. And I said, okay, okay, anything, you know. And I did. And this woman informed me that alcohol was a depressant, much to my surprise. I thought it was so good at being the chemist and only doing this kind of drug and only that much of this one and only drinking this kind of booze with that kind of drug. And, you know, I knew just how to do it, so I thought. And she said alcohol was a depressant. I didn't do depressants. I didn't do downers. Downers are not my thing. I didn't like them. A quarter of a Quaalude would make me go to sleep. You know, I just, they don't work for me. So I thought, whoa, that's really interesting. So I'm depressed and I'm pouring fuel on the fire, as it were, or water on more water, because God knows there was not much fire happening in my life at that time. So I kept trying during that. I saw her for a year, and she would never say that she wouldn't see me unless I got sober. She would say, I have a friend who went to AA and she really liked it. I have a friend. This friend of mine is still going to meetings, and she's really found it's done wonders for her and for depression and for her life. And she would just drop that in every once in a while. And every once in a while, I'd go back to meetings, and it would last about a month. I didn't get a sponsor. Anyway, long story short, I finally, I talked to my friend, Meryl, the belly dancer, who had gone to see a nutritionist to get her off of speed, which she used to stay skinny and dance all night and then work a straight job during the day. And I went to see him, and he said, I need to get blood samples from you, because he was another vitamin kind of guy. And he said, I need a completely clear blood sample, so you have to stop drinking, smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, all the vitamins that you do. And there was something else. Why I didn't have convulsions, I don't know, because I did stop all that for 5 days. And the only way I knew that the only way I could do it was to go to AA meetings. Because one thing I had found out in that 14 months time is that the day that I went to a meeting, I didn't drink. When I started drinking again, I had stopped going to meetings for a few days. And someone would put a drink in my hand, and that was that. I might not get drunk on a whole bottle of booze all night. I might have a half a glass of wine and feel it surge through my body and say, I am out the door. I need to cop some Coke immediately. So, and I never knew. And that's what happened in that year of up and down and drinking, not drinking. It really messed with my drinking. I didn't know what it was going to do anymore. So I knew that changes were happening. So for Dr. Bezoza, his name was, I got clean for a week, and I went, the only way I could do it, I thought I was jumping out of my skin, was to go to about 3 meetings a day. And that was my rehab. In New York City, it's easy to do that. I walked around the corner from my apartment and went to one at 7 o'clock in the morning. That was right off the bat. And then I take the bus up to that office where I still was. And I'd run out to the noon meeting, the mink coat meeting, and then I'd go back to work. And then I'd take the bus downtown to home, but I could never make it because I get so claustrophobic and crazy in the bus that I jump off at Beth Israel Hospital and run into the 5:30, you know, nurses and people after work meeting there. And then I started to feel better. I'd go home, have dinner with my daughter. And eventually, after about 2 or 3 weeks, I started going to evening meetings in my neighborhood. And there I found all my old friends from the bars who I hadn't seen in a few years. Where had they gone? Turned out they'd gotten sober, a lot of them. And I started going to the beginners meeting in Soho, where you sat around a table and, you know, it was a huge meeting, and it would, after the speaker, you'd break up into a one of those long, you know, folding tables. It seats about 8 people, and everybody would share. And, oh, I was so panicked. I could not share, you know, or I thought I couldn't share. I knew I was going to have to. I'd be thinking about it all the way around the table. And I would be in sweats. It was, of course, still all about me. And I learned how to do it. And I got a sponsor. And somebody said, oh, why don't you clean ashtrays? Everybody smoked still at meetings in those days, or at least half the room. And why don't you make coffee? I worked steps. You say your days in New York until you're 90 days sober, you put your hand up and say what day you are every single meeting that you go to. And until I was 45 days, I'll never forget that date. I had to look in my day timer to see what day it was because I would forget. My brain was so nutty from coming down by myself with no special extra drugs and not in a rehab and still going to work every day and still being a mom with a now teenage daughter who was really pissed off at me because I began to pay attention. And not have parties endlessly and to wonder about her drinking. I got her to go to Alateen for a while until she told me, Mom, she said, you know, it's the best place to cop drugs in New York. It was on the steps outside the Alateen meeting. I said, all right, you don't have to go anymore. But we tried. In any event, by the time she was 20, she told me that she thought that people couldn't change. But that she had changed, seen me change enormously. She was 14 when I got sober and pissed. By the time she was 20, she said, no, you've really changed. And in one way that I think I changed was I became slowly, slowly more comfortable in my own skin. I was no longer suicidal if you looked at me wrong. You know, I love that joke about AAs or the alcoholics are the only people who have to decide if they get a flat tire, if they call the suicide hotline or AAA. You know, and I am definitely that person. It's like, oh my God, which is why it's so amazing that I went through this whole day today and packing and seeing the fire planes going over and so forth. And I just sort of went right on smoking my cigar, you know, because for 35 years, I have not had a relapse. Until I moved to California when I was 8 years sober, I went to 5 meetings a week. Now, I moved from Manhattan to Inverness Park, so it's kind of a huge change. And you can go to 5 meetings a week out here, but it's not easy. And I started only going to maybe 3 meetings a week, but they had a fabulous fellowship out here. And I always also liked the thing we used to say in New York a lot, that New York is that AA is a bridge back to life. That yes, you still go to meetings and you have many AA friends, but you have many other friends. And when I moved out here, suddenly everyone I knew were people who didn't drink. Who knew? I didn't know people who didn't drink. I didn't know you went anywhere. And you know, I never went to coffee shops in New York. I went to bars. You have coffee in a bar. You know, until I got sober and met all of you all after meetings in coffee shops. Who I didn't know. That's who's in coffee shops, recovering alcoholics. Anyway, it's been an interesting and long journey. And I'm here to tell you that it gets better, that it gets more interesting. I would not still be here. I would not still be coming to meetings if I didn't like who I've become. I'm in a relationship now for 10 years that I haven't that I was alone until 10 years ago, except for my daughter, and then she moved out. And I tell people, I've met this man right before my 25th AA anniversary, and it's really true that it took me 25 years. For you newcomers, it may not take you that long, but it took me 25 years to be nice enough to attract a really nice man and to have a relationship that's sane and based on spiritual principles. I use AA as my main spiritual practice. I think it is a spiritual practice, and that the 12 steps we do are the same pretty much as everything taught by the Buddha and all the other great teachers. And I am very, very grateful to have been practicing them all these years. I needed them today. I need them now to talk to you. And I'll need them for the rest of my life. And I'm grateful to have them. Thank you.